thank you very much, and good afternoon to all of you. You know, I'm very honored to be here. I looked through the list of past speakers, and it's really a who's who of not only Catholic Chicago, but the Catholic country. So it's just a great privilege to be part of that group. Also, that the First Friday Club and I are both celebrating our 25th anniversary. This coming May will be my 25th anniversary as a priest, and I think the first Friday talk was June of 1986, so 1 month after I was ordained. So I'm delighted to be part of that little congruence. I want to talk to you about Christmas today. You know, Christians have been complaining for a long time about the commercialization of Christmas, and I certainly agree with that critique. But there's a more fundamental problem, I think, what I call the domestication of Christmas. Turning Christmas into a nice, sentimental family day. Now, mind you, I got nothing against sentiment. I've got nothing against family days. I'm all in favor of them. But I don't think that's the message the great evangelists wanted to communicate to us when they told the Christmas stories. Years ago, I read the great Birth of the Messiah by Raymond E. Brown, who was really the dean of Catholic biblical scholarship in the 20th century. He said this: "The Christmas stories are not idle tales that we tell to children, because they are full of the drama and countercultural power of the gospel." That's right, and that's the message I want to talk about more today. I think one of the best ways, perhaps, to defamiliarize Christmas a bit is to think about it this way. It's the introduction of Jesus the warrior. C.S. Lewis said this: "How come when the Son of God appeared, he appeared in such a quiet, unobtrusive way, being born this little child in a dusty outpost of the Roman Empire? How come he didn't appear with more pizzazz and panache?" Lewis's great answer: because he had to come quietly, slipping clandestinely behind enemy lines. Jesus came as a warrior in the midst of a world gone wrong. The Gospels present Jesus consistently as the Mashiach of Israel, the Messiah, the Christ. When Paul says Christos Jesus, it's just his translation of Mashiach Yeshua, Jesus the Messiah. If you look in the prophets and the Psalms, you see a very clear job description of the Mashiach emerge. When this great figure would come, he would first of all gather the tribes of Israel, making it again a great nation. Secondly, he would cleanse the holy temple in Jerusalem, make it again a place of right praise. And thirdly, he would deal with the enemies of Israel. The Mashiach would deal with the enemies of Israel, making it again a great nation. That was the expectation. What you see in the Gospels is, over and over again, this is the Mashiach. This is the Davidic warrior. But see, friends, here's the point. What a strange and surprising warrior he was. Now, with that in mind, let's go back to that familiar, in fact, all too familiar account in Luke's Gospel, the familiar Christmas story. Here's how Luke begins. Caesar Augustus proposed a census of the whole world. The census took place when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Now, that's precisely how you'd expect a poem or story to begin in the ancient world. You begin by invoking these high and great figures. Think of Virgil's Aeneid that begins, "Arma virumque cano, I sing of arms and of the man." It's a poem all about Aeneas, this great heroic figure. Gods and generals and heroes. And so it begins, Augustus and Quirinius. More to it, Augustus is doing a paradigmatically powerful thing. He's declaring a census of the whole world. Why is that a powerful thing? Because if you could count the people, you could draft them more efficiently, you could tax them more efficiently, you could control them more completely. So we have a typical beginning of a story in the ancient world. But then Luke pulls the rug out from under us, and we see now the first subversive move. Because the story's not about Augustus. It's not about Quirinius. It's about this little couple, Joseph and Mary, making their way from where to where. In the ancient world, if common people were mentioned in poems and stories, they were comic relief. They were a foil to the great heroes. You see what Luke is doing. Augustus is mentioned, so is Quirinius, but they're not the heroes. They're the comic relief. They're the foil. The story will emerge now, will unfold as the tale of two emperors. Caesar Augustus and Christ Jesus. And the implicit question, which emperor are you with? Look now. We hear that because of this census, Mary and Joseph have come to Bethlehem, the city of David. No first century Jew hearing the story would have missed it. A fighter has arrived. Bethlehem is David's city, the city of the great warrior king, the one who took on the enemies of Israel. Look at the beginning of Matthew's gospel. Remember it says there are three sets of generations that precede Jesus. Three sets of 14. 14 was the number in Hebrew, because every word corresponded to a number. 14 was the number that corresponded to David, David. Matthew's saying, David, David, David has come. Luke now, in his own symbolic way, saying, Bethlehem, the city of David, a warrior has come to fight. What do we hear? We hear, first of all, there is no room for Mary and Joseph even in the crummy traveler's hostel in Bethlehem. Even that extremely low-level place was too much for them. So Jesus is born in a cave, some say a stable. More recent scholarship is suggesting maybe just the lower level of a family dwelling where the animals were kept. But the point remains, a place of extreme simplicity and humility. Who was the best protected person in the ancient world? Protected from tectum, right? Roof. Who had the best roof over his head? Everyone in the ancient world knew it was Caesar Augustus in his palace on the Palatine Hill. You know, when you go to Rome and you walk through the Forum and you look up at the Palatine, that's where the emperors had their home. Which is why our word palace comes from Palatine. Who is the best housed, best protected figure in the ancient world? It was Caesar Augustus. But the true king comes not protected, but vulnerable in love. We hear the Christ child is wrapped up in swaddling clothes. Now, parents, grandparents, go back to when you first met your son or daughter, or grandson, granddaughter. I go back in my mind to when I met my nephew, who's now 11, so 11 years ago, when he was a day old or 2 days old, and I held him in one hand. He was that tiny, his head lolling to the side. Think of that image of absolute weakness. Now, wrap that child up in swaddling bands. Is there possibly an image of greater weakness, vulnerability than that? Who was the rangiest, freest, most powerful person in the ancient world? It was Caesar Augustus, whose will was law all throughout the Mediterranean basin, even up into the wilds of Germany and Britain. He was the strongest, freest, rangiest figure. But the new emperor, the true king, arrives, not in rangy freedom, but tied up, vulnerable to the other in love. We then hear that child is laid in the manger, the place where the animals eat. And again, if they were in a lower section of a house where the animals were kept, mangers would be there. Who was the best fed person in the ancient world? Everyone knew it was Caesar Augustus. He could snap his fingers, get any sensual pleasure he wanted. But the true king, the true emperor arrives, not feeding himself, but offering himself as food for the world. At the climax of his life, that baby come of age would say, "Take this, all of you, and eat it. This is my body. Take this, all of you, and drink from it. This is a cup of my blood." He's not one who's fed, but the one who allows himself to become food for the other. Here's the last detail, and we mustn't get sentimental about this one. We hear that in the hills around Bethlehem, shepherds were keeping night watch over their flocks. And suddenly an angel of the Lord appeared with the good news. Despite all the paintings by Raphael and many others, don't think of angels as cute little, you know, kids. What's the typical reaction to an angel in the Bible? But fear. Consistently, Old Testament and New, the reaction of an angel is fear. Imagine if a being from a higher dimension of existence suddenly broke into our world, the proper response would be fear. "Don't be afraid," the angel says. And then with him there appeared, in the Greek of Luke's Gospel, a stratia of angels. Now we often render that as host. You know what it means, though, in straightforward Greek? It means army. Our words strategy and strategic come from that. A stratios of angels appeared, an army. With this overwhelming figure, this single angel, there appears now an army of angels. You see the point Luke is making here? Who had the biggest army in the ancient world? Caesar Augustus, which is precisely why he was able to dominate it. How wonderful that the baby king, the new emperor, the true emperor, has a bigger army. Mind you, not a worldly one, not one that will fight with the usual weapons, but rather a spiritual army that will fight with the power of compassion, the power of nonviolence, fight with the power of love and forgiveness. But the baby king has the greater army. Which emperor are you with? That's the question, it seems to me, that Luke is posing. With Augustus permanently in mind, we see by way of contrast the new king, the true king.